a Radio Catskill.
Live from the Radio Catskill studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, smoke from Canadian wildfires is drifting across the U.S. again, triggering air quality alerts in cities far from the flames. What does this mean for our health and our emergency preparedness? We're talking with an emergency management expert about what drives this wildfire season and how we can be ready when disasters cross borders. It's National Farmers Market Week, and this year, the Wayne County Farmers Market is marking 50 years of bringing farm-fresh food to the community. We speak with co-manager Anita Avisado about this local institution's roots and its evolution. As the Grahamsville Little World's Fair returns, we're talking to members of the Small Town Country 4-H Club about how they're keeping rural traditions alive. And the chickens are back in Parksville for the 4th Annual Bacock Festival. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. NPR has learned President Trump is expected to sign an executive order today on retirement plans, including 401ks. The order will lay out ways for investors to insert, quote, alternative assets into the financial instruments. These could include real estate and digital assets, such as cryptocurrency. Stocks opened higher this morning as a new round of higher tariffs takes effect on goods from big U.S. trading partners. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 160 points in early trading.
Goods from Europe, Japan, and South Korea now face import taxes of 15%. Tariffs on goods from many other countries are even higher. The move pushes the average tariff on imported products north of 18%, compared to less than 3% at the beginning of this year. In a social media post overnight, President Trump boasted that the tariffs will raise billions of dollars for the federal government. Economists warn the import taxes will also lead to higher prices and slower economic growth. The Bank of England cut its benchmark interest rate today in an effort to prop up the UK's sagging economy. The Federal Reserve is widely expected to take similar action here in the U.S. next month. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Texas state Democratic lawmakers remain out of their state. They're trying to block any action on a Republican plan to redraw congressional districts in Texas. The GOP goal is to possibly send 5 more Republicans to the U.S. Congress, helping secure Republican control on Capitol Hill. President Trump says the FBI might have to help locate the Texas Democrats and bring them back. But Texas Democratic Congressman Mark Veazey says that is inappropriate.
It's not anything for the FBI to be involved in. It would be absolutely crazy for the FBI to be involved in that. It would be an abuse of their authority.
But U.S. Senator John Cornyn of Texas says the FBI has responded to his request. Cornyn says the FBI will locate the Texas state Democrats and investigate what he says are offenses. The chancellor of UCLA says the Trump administration has frozen nearly $600 million in federal research money. NPR's Corey Turner explains.
Last week, the Justice Department announced UCLA had violated federal civil rights laws, saying the school had acted with, quote, deliberate indifference in creating a hostile environment for Jewish and Israeli students. But it wasn't clear until this update from the school's chancellor that UCLA has had $584 million in research funding frozen. In a statement, James B. Milliken, president of the University of California, says the system has agreed to engage in dialogue with the administration, but that, quote, these cuts do nothing to address anti-Semitism. Ann Milliken says they ignore the extensive work the university has done to combat anti-Semitism. Corey Turner, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Fire officials in California say the Gifford Fire is growing. It has now scorched 150 square miles. It is only 15% contained. There are evacuation orders now in both Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo counties. Officials say at least 3 people have been hurt in the fire. A new study finds that the deadly wildfires that devastated Los Angeles last January were likely responsible for the deaths of more than 400 people. NPR's Alejandra Barunda reports that is far more than the official count.
The wildfires ripped through parts of the city and doused the region in toxic smoke and ash for weeks. Andrew Stokes is a biostatistician at Boston University. He and his colleagues looked at the reported deaths across the weeks after the fire and compared that number to the number of deaths expected without the disaster.
We found that wildfires contributed to at least 440 deaths during the acute period of the LA wildfires, compared to approximately 31 official deaths that were recorded over the same period.
The findings suggested
a substantial undercount of wildfire-related mortality in Los Angeles.
Climate-worsened disasters, including wildfires, are taking a bigger toll on Americans than is commonly recognized. Alejandra Borunda, NPR News.
United Airlines is clearing a backlog of flights today. The passenger airline had what it called a technology issue yesterday. More than 1,000 United flights were delayed across the country. United Airlines says the tech glitch has been fixed. This morning, the tracking site, FlightAware.com, says fewer than 10% of United flights are delayed or canceled. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at MelvilleTrust.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. This summer, wildfire season is once again making headlines, as you just heard from NPR News. Not just out west, but across the country. Wildfires burning in Canada have sent smoke drifting across the U.S. border once again, impacting air quality for millions from the Midwest to the Northeast, right here in our backyard. Meanwhile, there are massive wildfires near the Grand Canyon and in Southern California. To help us understand what's behind these fires and how we can better prepare and respond, we're joined live by Dr. Jochi Marumba, Assistant Professor of Emergency Management in the Department of Social Science and Public Affairs at SUNY Empire State University. She brings expertise in disaster preparedness, response, and the intersection of emergency management and public health. Dr. Marumba, welcome and thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me, Tim.
What's causing the scale and intensity of this year's wildfires in Canada?
Thanks for the question, and I have to begin by acknowledging that we have had some fatalities in these fires, and certainly extending just my heartfelt condolences to the losses, and also understanding that, as we previously heard, that the mortality rate from fires, in, as we have had them in California, we're having them now in Canada, and even in the U.S., tend to be undercounted at the beginning, but I honor those lives. And coming back to your question about what is causing the fires is that there's never really a single reason or a single cause, right? There's always a convergence of various factors that cause these fires. And yes, there could be the point of ignition, which is can be anything from, you know, lightning strikes, or sometimes we have it that it's just a fuel buildup in the forested areas. Sometimes it's arson. But even with those factors, there always are other underlying conditions that are oftentimes human-made that result in these fires.
Are we seeing new patterns that concern emergency managers when it comes to wildfires?
Significantly. We see a lot of causes that are not just new, but are different. But one thing we do need to understand is that wildfires have had a natural pattern, right? So they are a natural part of many ecosystems. The changes that we are seeing now, however, have to do with fires burning hotter, you know, having a larger, so just the geographic extension of fires becoming significantly increased. We're having fires more frequently, and we are also seeing fire seasons being extended, right? So that the recovery time, both for the ecosystem and for the people involved in the management of fires, just becomes shortened. So that those are some of the changes that we are seeing. And therefore, the approaches that we use in the field to try and manage just the frequency, the intensity, and the geographic location where these fires are burning is having to shift.
You know, all week long, we've looked outside and seen the hazy skies and know that the smoke is attributed to these wildfires in Canada here in the Northeast. Can you talk about how wildfire smoke travels and why is it such a major public health concern here in the U.S.?
It really should be a public health concern in the U.S. and also, obviously, in Canada. because we see ways in which people who are, you know, quite proximate to the fire are impacted. But we're also seeing and having to consider the global influence of disasters, right? Where in this case, we're dealing with smoke from a fire, but we also have seen previous public health impacts from other disasters that do not respect boundaries. Okay. So in this case, when you look at what is happening is that, you know, there's obviously the air movement that's causing the transference of the smoke. And therefore, when it comes to mitigation and preparedness of these wildfires and other disasters, the need for a cohesive approach that extends beyond geographical boundaries becomes an imperative. So, you know, when it comes to the plumes of smoke, they really are not respecters of boundaries, right? So to that extent, they will certainly flow across and impact people's health, people who are already predisposed to maybe upper respiratory conditions, especially the young and people who suffer from conditions like asthma. We see people who are elderly also being significantly impacted. You know, people who are expecting children are also more susceptible to smoke, and we also inhalation, and we also really do also have to consider that there's a larger ecosystem, right? In ways in which our plants, the animals, are also impacted by this fire.
You know, I have to admit that earlier this week when we started seeing the smoke from the wildfires here in our area, I was a bit surprised. I hear the news all day. I pay attention to the news. But are emergency systems keeping up with these repeated air quality alerts?
Good question. I like what you said, which is you had the visual, right? You had the visual experience of seeing the fire and not the fire, sorry, the smoke. And what we really also have to understand, and it is linked to the alerts, is that before you even see something, there is probably something in the air that, you know, the particles that you might not necessarily be seeing. So air quality alerts are very critical and important. And so understanding that there are so many different ways in which we can get alerts, so we would need to sign up to our local emergency management feeds, but also look at some of the feeds that we get on our phones or online for those people who spend time online is important for us. It's important for us to keep an eye on that. But sometimes there seems like there's so much information out there and keeping up might be overwhelming. So finding multiple ways to communicate the fire alerts or the smoke alerts, air quality alerts is important. We also need to understand that everybody's not using a smartphone, right? There are community members who are not necessarily using smartphones or they're not online. So making sure that important communication platforms like radio, mm-hmm. right, that we continue doing that. Announcements, whether it's physical announcements, whether they are billboards or notifications on the road are really, really critical. So being able, from an emergency management perspective, to understand that, yes, let's keep up with the technology, but let's also keep up with the communication of air quality alerts and other kinds of alerts as well, using the non quote unquote technological approaches. But also, you know, people are suffering from alert fatigue, right? Mm. When I referenced frequency of just air quality alerts. So people sometimes become inured to all these alerts. But understand, when people have a broader education and understanding of what is happening you know, within their region, yes, but also the ways in which global impacts could impact them locally, I think that is also a really important component of understanding the value and hopefully diminishing alert fatigue.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Dr. Jochi Marumba, Assistant Professor of Emergency Management in the Department of Social Science and Public Affairs at SUNY Empire State University, talking about wildfire season and the response and the intersection of emergency management and public health. I want to ask you a little bit more about the coordination of emergency managers mm-hmm. and how they handle these disasters that cross national and state lines. And what does effective preparedness look like at these various levels, local, state, federal?
So when you think about the work that it takes to actually coordinate the fires, we would be remiss if we didn't quite fully understand that the work does not happen at start at Ignition, right? There are multiple professionals who are involved even before you have had the fire seasons or before we have the fires starting. So in the real world, you actually have people who are already trying to understand different components of the fire and trying to understand the fires or you know, what the patterns are going to be for the year. You know, looking at data, looking at the research, trying to understand across different planners, different fire managers, fire ecologists, people who study fire behavior. You know, then you have people who are trying to think about the logistics, there's training, there's all this mitigation and preparedness that goes on before the fire season. And then during the fire season, then you have the response and the suppression component. And that's the most visible, you know, to us as the public, right? And so during this season, we are seeing a whole lot of people that are coming together in synchronicity to respond to what's going on. And it's everything from, you know, crews who are involved in managing the fires. You have people who are doing logistics. You have, you know, incident command staff, etc. My point here being that even in seasons when we're not actually seeing people responding to fire, there are people who are involved in the day-to-day. And this includes local level, like you mentioned, there's state, there's regional, there's national, there's federal, there's tribal as well. And I'd like to highlight this international component because we are experiencing it now to where we can see the need for collaboration across the boundaries, the geographical boundaries, you know, so that we can protect the health of the people who are being impacted by the smoke, you know, across the boundary, so to speak, right? So the planning is critical. And what you typically have is cross-boundary mutual aid agreements that are typical. You have synchronized training sometimes. You have research that crosses boundaries. You have a lot of training and exercises that should happen at local, state, and national level in preparation for fire seasons. So there's a lot of what is called in the field emergency management compacts where people actually are spending time ahead of the fires. And then when it comes to being able to work together cohesively during the disaster, then they are better prepared because, as we say in the field, they're not shaking hands in front of the disaster itself.
You mentioned that international aspect. France, Spain, and Portugal are currently battling wildfires amid a record heat wave there. In southern France, mm-hmm. at least mm-hmm. one person mm-hmm. has died and three people yes. are missing as they battle France's biggest wildfire in almost 80 years. There's a Grand Canyon fire that we mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. the Dragon Bravo fire at the Grand Canyon spreading to more than 126,000 acres. Can you talk yes. about the unique risks and challenges in responding to wildfires in remote or protected areas like that?
Yes. You know, again, and we're just coming off of the LA fires as well, where, right. you know, equally we see that it gets very, it's a different approach when you're dealing with, you know, different terrain, for example, right? So when you look at the unique risks and some of the challenges, you know, you're thinking about access to, you know, access limitations. Okay, and so the kind of crews and the kind of equipment that you need in isolated terrain is very different from, say, what you would need in an urban setting. So I reference us back to the kind of training and the kind of equipment and the kind of preparation that it takes to be able to respond. But you have professionals who are very aware, they're staying ahead of, you know, trying to understand and study what the latest technology, the latest practice, and trying to also influence policy so that the ways in which they are supported to respond to the different fires is unique and helpful, right? We also are very aware that when it comes to these challenges, is sometimes because of the terrain being so remote, there could be a delay in detection and response, right, due to limited surveillance. So again, you know, hearkening back to having monitoring and surveillance systems that are able to detect more you know, efficiently and effectively whenever fires are starting is important. Communication gaps has been the perennial struggle in disaster management and trying to really understand where it is that there has been miscommunication or delayed communication that has limited, that therefore has an impact on response, right? And then sometimes when you're looking at the terrains and the different lands, you also have to understand the cultural significance of land, right? So, for example, when you're looking at dealing with sovereign nations, the way in which that integration happens in protecting cultural land sites and historically protected areas, or looking at preservation mandates, for example, in national parks, those also present a very unique and a very important interface. So the way, because the ways in which the two entities or the multiple entities interact has to be respectful, right? Has to be aware of what the cultural differences are, what the preservation mandates are, and when it comes to dealing with, for example, sovereign nations that live amongst some of these lands, you also need to have a partnership, a pre-existing partnership, again, that does not begin at the site of ignition, at the point of ignition, but a relationship that precedes the actual disaster. So those are some of the unique challenges, but they are not unknown. Right. They really are situations that are known to the science. They're known in the field to be relevant. The question typically is, you know, how are we pre-event providing the resources, whether it's data, human, financial, or technical resources, to ensure that we are best prepared for the response and recovery season.
Is that how we support vulnerable populations better and improve public communication, that pre-event investment?
Absolutely. The pre-event investment saves us not only, you know, the agony of lost lives, the agony of heavier burden of fire or whatever the disaster is on already vulnerable communities, but we also certainly see that pre-event investments are critical for saving us actual money, right? There's a study that indicated some years back that for every dollar that is spent in mitigation, we're saving anywhere from 7 to 8 in response and recovery. So being able to communicate and implement data is also critical. And this requires not just community level engagement in planning, but it also requires the support of nonprofits, private entities. It requires certainly the support of our politicians and elected officials as well.
What role is climate change playing in these escalating fire seasons?
I think we have seen, by seeing some of what I referenced, which is just the raise in temperature averages, right? The increase in frequency and severity of our fire seasons, and also of droughts, right? Because it is the drought. The drier seasons have an impact on extending the fire season. So being able to understand that, whether you call it climate change or you go with it by another name, what we are seeing is that long term, what used to be a natural pattern, right, of wildfires, because wildfires are a natural part of any ecosystem, but the changes over time are so significant, we can tell that there is a change in the climate, right? So we certainly are seeing these changes. There's quantitative and qualitative records of how this has changed. And what we see is that this becomes a threat multiplier to where, whereas before we had, you know, a pretty understood season and a flow that allowed for adaptation of the ecosystem, and even just for the people who are responding to the fires, we are seeing that because of the increase in frequency, then that shortens the recovery time, and therefore the threats become multiplied as well.
Before we go, what's the key takeaway you want listeners to know when it comes to disaster readiness and air quality events?
I think it's critical for us to understand that the fire seasons are really part of the ecosystems. They're here to stay. I cannot say that enough, right? So it really is upon us all to certainly stay in touch with what it is that we need to know, what's the information that we need, and what is a reliable source of information that we can, count on, okay? Is it your local radio station? Is it a relative? Because sometimes that's part of the decision making. So how do you make your decision on how you keep up with not just fire season, air quality, but also the compounding realities of what fire seasons bring? And that includes your health. That includes the health of the people that you take care of, your animals as well. You know, we've got to take to be sure that we understand that. And people who live closer, certainly to areas where fires are frequent, just understanding that they also are very fast moving, very sometimes unpredictable air and weather patterns that also influence the speed at which these fires are occurring. And like you stated earlier, yes, there's the visible public health threat we see when we experience the fire, but then there's also the invisible ones. So what do we need, right, to take care of ourselves and also others? So awareness is critical, and it's part of resilience, or building resilience.
And it's this new reality we all have to get used to. Dr. Joachim Arumba, Assistant Professor of Emergency Management in the Department of Social Science and Public Affairs at SUNY Empire State University. Thank you so much for joining us and for giving us some more insight on how to be aware and ready.
It's been an honor. Thank you.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, fresh food, strong community, and five decades of tradition, the Wayne County Farmers Market is celebrating 50 years during National Farmers Market Week. We'll hear from the co-manager of the market about the past and the future after this. It's Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFRadio.org.
Hey, it's Ira Flatow from Science Friday. Public media organizations just lost federal funding, and it is a big deal. This cut will have serious long-term consequences for the service we provide to you unless we replace that funding with support from more listeners. The future of public media is in your hands, so please go to the station's website to start or increase your monthly sustaining donation today. And thanks.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's National Farmers Market Week, a national event that celebrates the huge role that farmers markets play in supporting local agriculture, strengthening community ties, and improving food access. Locally, the Wayne County Farmers Market is celebrating 50 years of farm fresh food. I spoke with Anita Avisato, co-manager of the Wayne County Farmers Market, about how the market got started and what's ahead.
So 50 years ago, there was a small group of farmers and producers that wanted to get their produce and products out to the customers. And they figured the easiest way to do that was to bring them to town, which is what they did. So there was a little nugget of people that got together, and they would every Friday afternoon set up in the parking shop. It was in the parking shop lot in Honesdale on Main Street, and sell their products. So they brought, fresh vegetables, baked goods. There was a man that sold honey. And it seemed to be a popular way for people to get their stuff sold and for people to buy fresh, healthy food.
What's changed over the years and what stayed the same?
Well, let's see. What's changed? Obviously, vendors have changed. I would say that what changed was the attitude toward buying from a farmer's market. It used to be, and I still encounter this every now and then, people would say, oh, I can't go to the farmer's market. This stuff is so expensive. But if you look today in a grocery store at the price of tomatoes, it's virtually the same as what we charge. As a matter of fact, last year when we were selling our tomatoes, we were selling them for cheaper than you could get them in the grocery store. And part of the reason for that is we just don't have the middleman costs that grocery stores do. What's stayed the same is it's all local. You know, everybody that sells at our market today is within, I'd say 30 miles of Homesdale, 30, 40 miles of Homesdale. So, and it's been successful.
Why do you think it's been so successful for so long, for 50 years?
Well, I think people realize that the food that they can buy today is just not the same. It's different. For instance, the food you even get today, well, they realize that preservatives don't really preserve you. They want to put food in their bodies that's not processed, that hasn't been manipulated or traveled 100 miles or whatnot and sat on a store shelf. Someone wants a tomato that they can say, oh, this was on the vine yesterday and you picked it today. Oh, fine. And I think part of the reason that they come to a farmer's market is because they can actually ask the farmer, you know, what do you use for pesticides? What do you use for fertilizer? What can I do with this basil? Or it's really, there's a direct communication and connection to people nowadays that we have, and I think they appreciate it.
Yeah, and I think there's something great about knowing your farmer and knowing where your food comes from and seeing it there if you're going on a weekly basis, every week something changing or something new, and then learning something new about those products. Let's talk about some of those farms and farmers that sell their products at this market. Can you highlight a few of those?
Actually, the co-manager, Brian Fox, and his wife, Rachel. Brian has been coming to this farmer's market for almost half of its existence, almost 25 years. So he's a regular there. And we also have a brand new farmer that came this year. It's his first year. He's a farmer from Pleasant Mount. He brings his vegetables and fruit, blueberries. We have a maple syrup producer who was, his mother was one of the original vendors, Jean Yatsansky. And his mother, Jean, came when they first started out on Friday afternoon or Friday evenings at the park and shop. And his sister, Carol Rutledge, and her husband, Jim, come and have been coming since the beginning. And they bring apples and produce and baked goods and flowers and cut flowers. We have a coffee vendor. We have a young gentleman who started a mushroom farm out in the Hawley area. He brings his products. We have quite a variety at our market of products and artisans, bakers. It's just, you really have to see it to appreciate it.
It is the height of the summer season, so there's a bounty of fruits, vegetables, everything out there. What are some things that folks are selling right now?
Oh, good grief. Everybody seems to have been waiting for the tomatoes, and we finally have tomatoes, peppers, greens. Let's see. Oh, and next week, this coming Saturday, we'll have sweet corn. That's another product that people want to know if we have sweet corn, and they ask us in May. But we will have it this week. Yeah. We will have it this weekend and continuing probably for the next couple of weeks.
Now, is there going to be a 50th anniversary celebration? And when and where is that going to be?
Well, yeah, and everybody's invited to that. That is going to be on Saturday, August 16th. It's going to run in conjunction with the farmers market, but we've got a lot of different things planned for that. And it was basically we wanted to just celebrate 50 years and honor the original founding members that had this idea for this way back when. So we're going to have quite a bit. It's going to be in full swing. We're going to have probably about 14 or so community organizations that are going to have displays and exhibits, and there'll be a lot of them that will have like a children's activity. We're going to have four local farm-to-table chefs who are going to do a pop-up restaurant and offer food. We're going to have music. The Old Time Fiddlers are going to be there. I think a lot of people are aware of who they are. There'll just be a lot of things. We're going to have a basket raffle that's going to benefit our Senior Farmers Market Coupon Fund. About 2018, the vendors of the market wanted to do something to help the senior citizens that are there, that just to help them get a little extra bang for their buck. So if you're a senior that gets the Senior Farmers Market vouchers from the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture, you can bring your vouchers to our market, and we will give you an in-kind, same amount coupon that's good for anything you want to purchase at the market. Mm. So you're kind of getting like double your money back from that coupon. And that fund, when we started doing it in 2018, I think we maybe gave out $250 worth of coupons. Last year, it grew. It's been growing and growing. And last year, we gave out almost $4,000 worth of coupons to seniors in the area to use. And they were able to purchase, you know, honey or meats or eggs or vegetables or whatever they needed. And it was just a way to get back.
Now, it's National Farmers Market Week, the national celebration of the vital role farmers markets play in the nation's food system. What more can folks do to help keep the farmers market thriving there in Wayne County?
Well, number one, come down to the market. You might be pleasantly surprised that you can get really good stuff there. They can, well, just to support the market in any way they can, come down and if you can't visit us, at least let other people know that there is a market in the area that's available. I think out-of-towners, visitors to our area would benefit. But just let people know that it's out there and come and stop in and see. Stop in and see for yourself what's down at the market.
Any hopes or plans for the next 50 years you want to see there at the market?
Well, I'm hoping to not be doing this market in 50 years, but yeah, I guess I kind of do have some hopes for the future. I'm hoping that more and more people will realize the benefits of eating fresh and in season vegetables and local. Because when you buy local, you don't just support the farmer, you support everybody that the farmer supports. Where they buy their gas, where they go for, appliances or something like that. They support the local economy. We all have to help each other out. And I think another hope for the future would be that there is going to be future farmers that want to do this, and future bakers and producers and artisans that are going to find satisfaction in continuing the market. I'm hoping they're out there.
That's Anita Avisado, co-manager of the Wayne County Farmers Market, which is in Honesdale every Saturday at 9:30. They have a big 50th anniversary celebration of that farmers market on August 16th. And there's more information at the Wayne County Farmers Market Facebook page. Anita, thank you so much.
Oh, Tim, you're more than welcome. Just make sure everybody gets an invite. We'd love to see you.
And we'll take a quick break. When we come back, we're talking to members of the Small Town Country 4-H Club about their Graham's World Little World's Fair exhibits, the livestock auction, and keeping rural traditions alive. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, it may be too hot to even think about turning on your oven, but we're going to do our best to make you want to. We've got summer baking with the Pie Queen of Los Angeles and a 60-time Blue Ribbon winner at the Iowa State Fair. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's fair season in the Catskills, and that means young farmers and future leaders are stepping into the spotlight. The Grahamsville Little World's Fair, one of the oldest country fairs in New York, and a cherished local tradition, is coming up. And among the highlights, the 4-H exhibits and livestock auction, where months of hard work come to life. Joining us now are Jenny Phelps, leader of Small Town Country 4-H Club, along with a few of her club members, Maylee Phelps and Alice Ferber. Hello, how are you guys? Good morning.
Good morning.
Remember when I said you can't be this quiet when we're on air? We're on air. How are you guys doing? Can you tell us a little bit about the Small Town Country 4-H Club and your involvement with the Grahamsville Little World's Fair? It's a big event, right? Maylee, do you want to tell us?
So every year, the 4-H goes to the Grahamsville Little World's Fair, and we all show the animals that we worked all year to raise and get ready for the fair, and then all of our still exhibits that we have worked on throughout the year.
And the fair is coming up next weekend, and a big event that you prepare for basically all year long. Why does this weekend next coming up matter so much to you guys?
It's the culmination of the 4-H year. The fair runs August 15th through 17th, and the kids are bringing all their hard work to the public to showcase everything that they've worked on all year long, and it's like the grand finale of the 4-H year.
Yeah. So, Alice, do you want to tell us a little bit about the artisan market? There's crafts and paintings and pottery. Tell us a little bit about some of the things at the artisan market.
The artisan market has tons of still projects that kids have been working on, and they've worked so hard on it, and so they'll be selling it at the artisan market.
Can you tell us a little bit about a few of the things that folks are working on? Do you have some friends from your club that have got some things in the artisan market?
Yeah, some of us that are in the club are selling jewelries, paintings, pottery, woodworking, crafts.
All kinds of stuff, right?
Yeah.
All right. So the big thing, though, is the livestock market and agricultural product auction. I understand that both of you have entries, multiple entries into that. Maylee, do you want to tell us about what you have in the livestock market and product auction?
Yeah. So I have a market lamb, and then I have honey and eggs.
So when you say market lamb, can you tell folks who may not understand what that means, what that means? What's a market lamb?
So it's a lamb that is raised who is going to be sold for meat.
So you know going in. And what do the judges look for in this particular event?
The structure of the animal.
Okay. Meaning like how big it is, if it's good weight, those kinds of things. What are the sort of criteria that you have to make sure that you get your lamb ready for market?
I have to meet a certain weight.
Okay.
And then I have to work with her so that she doesn't try to run away from me while I'm showing her.
And then can I just ask you this? Do you get attached at all? Or do you know that lamb's going to go over there? You kind of know that's part of agricultural life, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. What about eggs and honey? How are those different when it comes to what you're doing in this particular auction?
So I won't actually be selling the animals. I will just be selling their product that they produce.
Okay.
So I still take care of the animals, mm-hmm. but then I take the eggs from the chickens and I will sell those, and then I can still get more eggs after.
And are the eggs, is this a judging thing for the eggs? Is this part of it too, or is it just an auction?
So they first have to get judged in the still exhibit part, and then they will be put into the auction.
What makes a good egg?
The size, the shape.
Does color have anything to do with it? I always think the farmer's market eggs that I get that are green are like somewhat special. Are they?
It depends on the breed of the chicken.
Okay.
So the breed makes different colors of eggs.
What kind of breeds of chickens do you have for your eggs in this auction?
So we have a barnyard mix of chickens.
It's a mix.
I'm going to bail her out here.
That's so, okay. You can just move that mic over a little.
We have some Bielefelders and some Rhode Island Reds and just a variety of different kinds of chickens.
All right. And then, Alice, you've got a trio of turkeys, I understand, mm-hmm. and a pig. tell me about the trio of turkeys. Why three?
the trio, I'm selling three because it's a male and two females. So they're like mating paired.
And then a friend. No. Okay. So, but then, so what are the criteria, just like I asked Maylee about, like for the lamb, what are the criteria the judges look for when it comes to the turkey?
Like the size, the weight, how the body is structured.
Yeah. And then when it comes to the pig, what do they look for there? Kind of similar stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah. And have you entered into these events before?
Yes.
And what kind of, were they similar animals or different animals?
Similar and different.
How did you do?
Pretty good.
Yeah. Can you tell us, like, did you get a first place or a second place?
Got some first place with some of my animals.
Nice.
Some second places.
How do you feel about that when you get that, like, ribbon after, you know, all that work?
I get really happy and excited.
Yeah. Okay. And then we want to talk about more ways that we can support the kids and 4-H and the fair and all the agriculture in the area. Jenny, do you want us to tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. So I would really encourage everyone to come on Sunday, August 17th at 1 p.m. to support our youth, because we need to remember that these kids are our next generation of farmers. They're our leaders in ag and the ag innovators. And every bid that you place against on their items goes directly back to the youth, helping them fund their future projects and reaching their college goals and more. So keep in mind that 85% of the funds go to the youth, and 15% goes into a scholarship fund that's available for all 4-H'ers that participate in the auction. So as they move on to college, there'll be some money available for them to encourage their education, no matter what they're studying. And so please join us on Sunday, August 17th at 1 o'clock at the Grahamsville Little World's Fair, and the auction will be held in the upper ring.
And Maylee and Alice, before we go, I just want to ask you, you mentioned, you know, your future here, maybe going to college. Do you want to continue in agriculture, or do you have an idea of what you want to do yet?
Yeah. I want to continue on the family farm.
That's cool. How long has your family farm been around? Mom knows.
Our farm's been since 1932.
Wow. So you're carrying on that tradition. Very cool. And Alice, same for you?
Yeah.
Well, thank you guys for being here, and good luck with the animals and the products that you have in the auction and the market at the Grahamsville Little World's Fair. I think you guys have a 4-H page on Facebook, the Small Town Country Action 4-H page. They're from Hortonville, New York, right here down the road. It's Maylee Phelps and Alice Ferber and Mom, the leader of Small Town Country 4-H, Jenny Phelps. Thank you guys so much for coming in. Thanks for carrying on the agricultural tradition in this, in the county, and good luck again.
Thank you for having us.
Hey, now coming up next, there's the 4th annual Book Hawk Festival in Parksville. I don't know if you've heard about that. They're celebrating the chicken. There is someone here dressed as a chicken. I would like for you to see if they would pass muster at the auction on your way out, if you could, if you don't mind. Okay. Thank you. All right. We'll be back and talk to more about the 4th annual Book Hawk Festival coming up in Parksville. You're listening to Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFRadio.org.
Hey, this is Matt Hurtado. Join me for Virtual Soundscapes, your gateway to the best music in gaming. Classic tracks from the 8-bit era, modern releases, and interviews with the minds behind the games. Thursday night at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Hi, this is Angela Page from Folk Plus. Tune in Sundays at 2 and hear contemporary singer-songwriters and their creative works all woven around a theme. That's Folk Plus, Sundays at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, get ready, Parksville, because Saturday, August 16, the chickens are coming home to Main Street. It's the return of the Book Hawk Festival, now in its 4th year, bringing live music, art, food, vendors, a stilt-walking band, and plenty of fun for the whole family. It's a full-on celebration of community creativity and chickens. Joining us live now to talk about what's in store are co-festival organizers Adrian and Todd Perlmutter. Adrian, Todd, thank you for being here. And why are we celebrating the chicken again?
Well, I just want you to know that Adrian is a Baltimore Yellowfoot. I'm going to interpret for her for the purposes of this interview.
Okay, thank you.
And
I should get Maylee and Alice back in here to help too.
Yeah,
but sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, so the basically, like, everybody, you know, most people love chicken, and we decided that it was a great way, a good canvas to do a lot of other things, vendors, art, music, and stuff like that. And we just center it around the chicken. And am I catching everything? Yeah, she agrees.
It's year four. Did you ever think that it would take off the way that it has?
I mean, I was hoping that that was going to happen. And, you know, Adrian agrees. We were always planning on building it and, like, keeping it going and trying to do more interesting things each year. I mean, this year is like a whole new world of stuff. The band on stilts over the top.
I mean, that's a whole thing in itself. But for folks who've never been, give us the vibe. What's it like when you step into Main Street, Parksville for Bacock? Are there many people dressed as chickens?
There's going to be, we're actually talking about having actual chickens there. And we do have a chicken mobile that that was donated for the day for the event that rolls around. And there's a lot of chicken food vendors. This year is a great food year. We have four. Yeah. What do we have first? Oh, we got a jerk chicken.
I don't know if that's enthusiasm or concern.
she wants to make sure I get it right.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. So jerk chicken, 876 jerk. Oh, and then there's Bistro to Go is making chicken. Oh, Van Smokey is making smoked chicken. And then, we got Julius Margot from Mountaindale are doing tacos and empanadas.
And let's talk about the stacked lineup of music here. The Giraffes, Gorilla Toss, and that stilt band.
Yeah,
tell us more about
Shinbone
that.
Alley stilt band. I mean, they're going to walk around on stilts and start juggling, like, to entertain the kids early on. So that's like the first big event is going to happen early. So get there with the events noon to six. And then, you know, definitely on the early side, come to check out the stilt band. It's incredible. We tried to get them last year. What was the problem? Yeah, they weren't available.
What about the stuff for kids and crafts? And you mentioned the food. What else can folks look forward to?
We have games. There's egg toss. There's a crowing contest. There's kids chicken art contest. And there's a kids art tent. Art installations, vendors. You know Zach Max, who makes all the big
metal the big sculptures.
He's making a bunch of chickens he's going to sell.
Wow. Okay, cool. And then
let me finish out the music just for a second.
Well, go ahead. Sorry.
I just want to add there's some local bands, The Boss's Wife and also Creatures is coming. Gorilla Toss, Livingston Manor's Finest, is going to do a DJ set. Cool. So we're really excited about that. And then returning... they did the very first Bacock we did was the Giraffes from Brooklyn with their monster absolute fun power rock. And so they're going to be headlining and that'll be closer to like five.
We've talked over the years about Parksville and the, you know, regeneration of that community. What's it been like to see it, take off like this?
What's that? It's been incredible. I mean, working together with all the artists and the people at New Memories and Rob and Kim over at the Double Up and just seeing a community of artists and musicians, coming together. I mean, Peter and Gorilla Toss have been throwing shows at Memories, and we've been doing our other events there, the TSTS Festival and the Ghoul. So it's every year we're getting more and more people just can't believe that this is all happening in Parksville, in the ghost town.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's what people described it as before, but you guys are bringing it alive. And as co-organizers of this festival, you're heavily involved. What's something someone might be surprised about when it takes to organize a festival like the Bacock Festival?
There's a lot of there's a lot of scheduling. We need a lot of volunteers.
Adrian
getting all the food. Yeah.
Adrian seems to be stressed.
Yeah. Oh, and Adrian's complaining about all the social media that she has to.
Let's remind folks about when this is coming up, and if somebody's on the fence about it. If they're in the roost and not ready to come, what would you say to convince them to get them there?
I mean, the variety of entertainment and food that's going to happen. I mean, I don't think you're going to see anything. Also, the only place, I guarantee, it sounds like a lot of things are happening Saturday the 16th, but I'm pretty sure that we have the only band on stilts.
I think that's true.
Marching band.
I have not heard about that yet. Yeah.
All the entertainment sponsored by the Parksville Arts Center. And the entire event is happening through a grant from the Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association. Thank you, Sullivan Catskills Visitors Association.
Where can folks get more information about the full lineup?
You can go to the ParksvilleArtsCenter.com/events page. And there's an Instagram, the Parksville Bacawk, at the Parksville Bacawk, right? B-K-A-W-K. Is that right?
Yeah.
And
Facebook.
Oh, Facebook. Yeah, there's a Facebook, the Parksville Bacawk Facebook page as well.
Adrian questioning her commitment now to this. Get the information out, Doc.
Yes.
Any big dreams before we go for next year's Bacawk, giant inflatable chickens? I don't know. Chicken parade. We're ready for it, whatever it is.
I feel like we just want to keep amping it up. Like right now, this year, we've gotten more food vendors and more chicken options. And then next year, we want to have even more. More people come, we can help, provide even more variety of things. And maybe by next year, we'll go into the night. Right. As of right now, it's just 12 to 6, just a day's event. Yes. Yeah. Oh, are you going to, we wanted to throw a shout out to, All Things Good Festival at New Memories this weekend. Just wanted to throw that out.
Had around earlier to talk about that too. Bacawk After Dark. That sounds interesting.
Yes.
Adrian and Todd Perlmutter of Bacawk, the fourth annual festival celebrating our chickens, coming up, next weekend, the 16th.
Noon to 6.
Thank you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for your commitment to your craft. And that's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. And folks, if you thought that public radio is not valuable, you just heard why. You're not getting this anywhere else. You don't get the chickens commenting on the festival anywhere else. Public radio is here to support our community, and we need your support. And you can support us at wjffradio.org. We have been defunded, but we're not defeated. With your support, we'll be around for another Bacawk Festival and another 35 years of public radio. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hi, I'm Kimberly Izar. Listener support is what keeps Radio Catskill running. It's your donations that keep us on the air and fund the staff and programming that bring local news, culture, and NPR to the Catskills, Northeast Pennsylvania, and beyond. But did you know your support also helps all of our news partners? Here's Philip Antuso from the Times Union Hudson Valley.
I've been coming on Local Edition for years now, and it's a way to get Hudson Valley stories and state stories out to a Catskill listening audience. And that obviously redounds to our benefit. And, you know, you guys have provided reporting that we've shared. The relationship that the Times Union has with Radio Catskill has just made me more aware of what's going on and brought more things onto my radar.
And here's Liam Mayo from The River Reporter.
It's incredibly helpful to be able to find a wider audience for our reporting. It's incredibly helpful to be able to talk about these stories over the air in ways that we don't, get to in the printed versions of the newspaper. But it's also just really important, I think, to have colleagues in the community. Like, any one organization can only cover so much. And having Radio Catskill healthy, having Radio Catskill, fully supported by the community is really more important now than ever.
Your donation powers the news, music, and community voices you count on every day. Help keep Radio Catskill strong. Donate now at WJFFradio.org. That's WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. The forecast for today looks like it's going to be partly cloudy, and we'll see some Highs around 76 degrees. No air quality alert in effect, according to the National Weather Service, but still some lingering effects of that smoke from the Canadian wildfires. Hazy. Few clouds tonight, a low near 55. Some clouds in the morning tomorrow, giving way to mainly sunny skies for the afternoon, and a high of 78. On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.